It's party time. Does it feel like party time? Post-Easter, it's not the season when we normally think of parties, is it, really? We tend to associate parties more with Christmas, the New Year, wedding anniversaries, birthdays, things like that, but post-Easter. Yet in the lives of the followers of Christ, if you think about it, post-Easter, after he has risen, it's party season. When people have said their loudest and sternest and clearest no, Easter, God said yes, or I should say pre-Easter, God said yes. At Golgotha, people did their best to say no to God with great forcefulness. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, God, with greater forcefulness, said yes. Nobody was expecting that. Pilate, he said no in his hall of judgment, hastily washing his hands. The Roman army, they said no with its bloody public execution. Tradition. Tradition said no with its borrowed grave sealed with a huge stone rolled in front of it. Excuse me. The woman came to the grave. But their word, well, it was a sad no. Because actually they had only come to embalm the body. Peter and John later ran back to the tomb. But that was because earlier on that they had gone away. They had given up. They had withdrawn. They had said no with their feelings. Two on the Emmaus Road, well, they said no. They had left town, left the garden, left the grave. They had hoped that Jesus was the one. But they left town disappointed, with no on their lips. And then in the upper room, the rest of the group gathered, hiding out in fear and grief. Jesus was gone. They could be next. Theirs was a terrified no. Unanimously, among friend and foe alike, the word of the hour was no. So when it happened, when God said yes, there was nobody sitting by the graveside. There was nobody standing by the rock. There was nobody hiding in the nearby bushes even. And God, as he often does because of our doubt and disbelief, came up to them, snuck up on their blind side, if you like. He slipped in and surprised them. No wonder Easter is the highlight of the Christian year, and what a reason to celebrate. What a party. And look at the guest list to the party. God is so extravagant as to invite everybody to the party. You would have thought that God might have been a little bit more selective, but the fact that you and I are here is evidence that God will invite anybody. The party, if you like, was last week. That was Easter, Easter Sunday. And churches around the world, well, today, a week later, they're not quite as full, are they? Those of you who went to Bethlehem on Easter Sunday, 10 o'clock service, discovered that there was no room. It was packed. Overfill. Party day. Resurrection day. So you could argue that party day has come and gone. Have you ever been late to a party? Generally, my personality type, I don't like being late to things, and that can annoy Gay immensely at times. Not that she likes to be late either, but I'm often super early. Maybe I suffer from a bit of FOMO, fear of missing out. I don't want to miss any of the fun. And if you're late, you can sometimes have trouble catching up with what people are talking about or what has happened. Yeah, someone makes a reference to something that happened earlier and you're there, I don't understand, you know, insider joke or whatever. You just miss out on things and everyone laughs but me. And I don't like that. I want to be there. I want to be part of it. But if you're late, you can miss out. The week after Easter is like, if you turn up the week after Easter, it's like coming late to the party. Yes, we can recall some of the excitement of last week, you know, Holy Week. Here we had three reflective services during the week and they were great, and we had the art stuff outside and it was fascinating to see who paused and stopped to that. There was the Good Friday service and the Easter Sunday service that we had with BBC. It was a full-on party time. The celebration was great, but now, after Easter, we're missing the enthusiasm a bit. That swell of emotion that happened back then, that elation as the auditorium fills with worshippers. Do you know what this Sunday is called in church tradition? Does anyone know that? What's it called? Exactly. Well done, Heather. Go to the top. I should give you a chocolate. I'll give you one later. It's Low Sunday. Low, L-O-W. Low Sunday. And from what I can understand, they don't actually know how it come to be known as that, but probably it's just the contrast between High Sunday, the week before when everything was woohoo, and there's just this lowness. It certainly is often Low Sunday emotionally and numerically in churches. We may not notice the numerical low if it wasn't for going to BBC on Sunday and seeing the huge numbers of crowds that they had there. And as we consider this picture of being late to the party, I think one of the disciples can help us with our journey. Thomas. Thomas came late to the party. He missed Easter by a whole week. All the others were in the upper room when Christ stood among them, and Jesus, he came to them and he blessed them. Shalom. Peace be with you. He commissioned them into their own ministry. He said, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. And then he equipped them with his continual presence, receive the Holy Spirit. This was a huge day, and Thomas was late. It would have been amazing to be part of the whole experience. Would have been, you know, just imagine what that would have been like. You know, and as they spoke and they interacted with Jesus who had just been crucified, buried just days before, this would have been a huge party. But where was Thomas? Thomas missed it. He wasn't there. Nobody knows where Thomas was. Where do you think he was? Was he off, sort of caught up in the shock and grief, just wanting to be alone? Was he sitting at the local cafe having a cup of coffee? Had he gone to the park to feed the ducks? Or maybe, just maybe he was visiting the sick and imprisoned and clothing the naked and feeding the hungry. He had been listening to Jesus for 3 years. Maybe he had got on with it. There's no way to know where he was or what he was doing. We are only told where he was not. Thomas was not locked up in fear with the other disciples in the upper room. That's really the only thing we know. We have a tendency to give poor old Thomas a bit of a hard time, don't we? When we sort of talk about this stage of his life. You know, we criticize Thomas for being absent, even though there have been times when we ourselves have been late or absent or missing something important. We criticize Thomas because he represents all of those people who we think should be here. Now, why aren't they here? Should be attending church on Sundays, not missing out. Or we judge him because when he was told about the resurrection, he refused to believe it. We consider that's incredible. Why wouldn't he believe the others, what the others told him? And of course, Thomas was no different from the other 10 apostles. When the woman told them, they thought that what the woman said was nonsense. They didn't believe them, so they ran out to check it out for themselves. Well, we don't judge the other 10 for doubting, only poor old Thomas. So we know very little about Thomas. Actually, we actually don't know his name. We know him by a characteristic. Not that he was doubting Thomas, not that characteristic, but that he was a twin. I was meant to put that up. Forgot. So Thomas was a twin. That's what Thomas means in Aramaic. So he's actually just called the twin. That's it. He's identified simply as the twin. He's listed in the middle of the 12 all four Gospels when the disciples are laid out, that he's right at smack in the middle. Which, what does that mean? Middleham Thomas, he was neither strong nor weak. There's no way to discern, really. His interaction with others start to give us some clue of what Thomas was like. When Jesus started his journey towards Jerusalem, back a few chapters from the death and resurrection, all the disciples attempted to dissuade him from going into the lion's den in Jerusalem. I'm sure you remember the story. All the disciples says, no, Jesus, don't do this. All except Thomas. It was Thomas who said, let us go along with the teacher so that we may die with him. Now, I wonder what tone that was said in. Was it done in a tone of sad resignation? Let us go along with the teacher so we may die with him. Or was it loyal commitment? Let us go along with the teacher so that we may die with him. Who knows what expression Thomas was using? I would like to think it was the latter. It was this loyal commitment. But if it was, he certainly abandoned his loyalty later on because he, like the rest, scattered in the face of Jesus' persecution and execution. And then during the last meal Jesus ate with his disciples, he said that when Jesus said that he was going away and they knew the way to go there, the way that he was going, well, the rest of them sort of nodded and smiled, but Thomas didn't. And he was willing to admit, and even admitted that he didn't have the foggiest idea of where Jesus was going and nor how he was going to get there. And so he said so. Thomas was known as a person of honesty and integrity. Thomas raised the tough questions, the kind that made everyone around just feeling a little bit nervous and uncomfortable because no one knew the answers, but they were too afraid to ask. None of them thought you ought to admit that you did not know something. You're meant to just remain silent and nod and smile and pretend that you're more intelligent than what you are. But not Thomas. Thomas refused to silence the integrity of his mind. Faith and reason would be joined for Thomas. Or he would know the reasons why not. He wanted to wrestle with the issues. This type of integrity and honesty is essential for emotional, mental, physical, and spiritual health. There are plenty of people around who would clearly indicate that when it comes to matters of religion, don't think, just believe. Well, that's certainly not Thomas. Faith was both a matter of the heart and the head. And if you didn't integrate those two things, that was a breach of integrity, certainly as far as Thomas was concerned. Thomas was also a person of doubt. He was a realist. His world left no room for the resurrection. When a person was dead, he was dead. That's simple, isn't it? He had seen Jesus die, and he would not settle for this hearsay comments, this second-hand faith that these people seem to have. You know, this was an inadequate foundation for his belief. In the midst of his doubt, Thomas did not put down the belief of others or attempt to force his doubts on them. When the disciples told Thomas that Christ was alive, he didn't say, "Oh, you guys are so stupid. Surely you don't believe that ridiculous nonsense." And neither did he say, "I'll never believe such a tale as that." Rather, Thomas responded, "I won't believe the story until I have first-hand experience. By seeing the scars, by putting my finger in the scarred hands and putting my hand in the wounded side." No person's faith can rest on another person's experience. Oh, sure, we can benefit from knowing about the journeys of others. You know, that they can be a great encouragement. You know, what routes they might have taken, how their faith has developed. Those are all fascinating things. And we can appreciate and we can be strengthened by comparison and contrast, and that can be really helpful. But we cannot adopt someone else's faith. People have to move beyond the faith of their parents, their teachers, their friends, whoever it is that has led them this far. Otherwise, all as they have is hand-me-down religion. And a hand-me-down religion won't survive the first serious crisis. Second-hand religion has little, if any, genuine faith in it. It just accepts what we've been told. It doesn't survive the first serious grief or the first major temptation or, for the younger, the first year at university. Some people don't have much religion to lose, and some, well, it's not worth keeping because it isn't really theirs anyway. So when the disciples told Thomas about the resurrection, I'm sure there would have been a part of Thomas that wanted to say, "Yes, I believe. After all, these were 10 of his closest friends, and they couldn't all possibly be wrong, could they?" But Thomas couldn't say that. He couldn't say, "I believe," honestly. What he could not say honestly, he would not say. And he certainly wouldn't fake it until he made it. One philosopher observed, "The atheist staring out from his attic window is often nearer to God than a believer caught up in his own fake image of God." It's an interesting quote, isn't it? Here's another one. "The serious atheist who wrestles with ultimate questions is likely to contribute more to intelligent understanding of both God and man than the pious believer who placidly attempts prevailing views." You might need to read that 3 or 4 times to work that one through. But there are many within Christianity who have been suspicious of questions that might upset the truths of the church, and they therefore don't ask the question. They don't challenge people. Copernicus, Galileo, Darwin have all been opposed and denounced by many in the church. And these attitudes came from the believer is supposed to think, is not supposed to think, but just believe. So Thomas was a person of honesty and a person of doubt. He refused to say he believed when he didn't. But please notice that there was no record of coercion from the other disciples to try and force Thomas to believe, to tell him that he had to. There's no indication that, that there was a refusal, that his refusal to believe Christ, that Christ had been resurrected, was a threat to the group. There was no one saying, well, you can't be part of our group anymore. If you don't believe the same as all we do, the door is closed to you. So Thomas was a person of honesty, a person of doubt, and a person of commitment. Thomas had been straightforward and about his doubt. He'd been open about it. He needed some first-hand proof of the resurrection. I wonder what his immediate reaction was that week later when Jesus appeared with the disciples and invited Thomas to touch his scars. Certainly we've got some of the reaction there in the Bible, but I wonder if he would have said, how did you know what I said? Who told on me? Would have been this suspicion that who dobbed me in? Who made me look bad in front of Jesus? But suddenly Thomas, he no longer needs any proofs. Without touching Jesus at all, Thomas exclaims, my Lord and my God. Thomas now had faith. Yep, Thomas was late to the party, but he partied hard and he caught up. It would have been appropriate, perfectly appropriate, just for him to say, my Lord. But Thomas spoke to Jesus as Israel had spoken to Yahweh, my Lord and my God. And these are the last words of Thomas recorded by John. Thomas had said all that there was to say. As I said before, we've often sort of criticized Thomas, berated him, referred to him as doubting Thomas. Why have we not given equal time to the leap of faith expressed in his confession and commitment? Why haven't we called him believing Thomas? In the presence of Jesus, Thomas's faith was made whole. Doubt dissolved, assurance emerged. The honesty of Thomas was still intact, and his confession was a statement of fact. John closes his gospel with this. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these have been written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. John is talking to the readers of his gospel, us, basically. And the Bible is intended to produce in us the same kind of faith that emerged in Thomas. This kind of faith begins with honesty. Everything needs to be on the table. Faith and reason learn to work together. We're allowed to ask all of those questions. There's no questions that are dodged. If doubts arise, that's fine. Grab hold of those doubts and work them through. As someone said, doubt is the mother of faith. You may have come to genuine first-hand faith in the resurrected Christ in some other way. Maybe it's the person you might have come to faith like Mary Magdalene as you sat at the feet of Jesus, that you listened to him. Or maybe Peter was more your model, an action of man, of going out there and doing it. But for me, I relate to Thomas. Thomas is a partner and brother in faith, as far as I am concerned. I question, I doubt, I wrestle. I don't believe everyone else. I'm a skeptic. If you still need to come to faith, don't quit, don't give up. If you've got doubts, that's fine. If you're struggling to reconcile faith and reason, read a bit about Thomas. He sorted it through. He's the patron saint of all of us who come late to the party. But we still come. Shortly we're going to take communion. And obviously as we take the bread representing his body and the juice representing his blood, we pause and we think of Easter. And we think of what Christ has done. And I guess I want you to pause and think, why do I believe? What has been part of my journey? And just remember, what has brought you this far? What were some of those initial convictions or experiences right way, way back at the beginning? What was a recent experience of God? Last week, last month. And think through, this is why I celebrate and remember your death and resurrection. If you'd like to talk to someone about that, either tap someone on the shoulder or after the service, come forward and someone will be quite happy to pray with you or listen to you and talk with you. If those who are helping out with the communion can come forward. Thanks.